It's my privilege today to welcome our speaker. Just to give you some of her background, our speaker today is a canon lawyer who since the year has served as judge and defender of the bond in the tribunal of the Diocese of. She also serves as a tribunal judge for the Diocese of. She is adjunct faculty at and has served as adjunct faculty at. She also serves as adjunct faculty in the formation program for the permanent diaconate canon law instructor for the Diocese of. Among her many accomplishments, she has given many workshops throughout the diocese in a variety of ministries and religious education courses. As a graduate of High School, she received a Bachelor of Science from University, Master of Arts in Ministry from College, Master of Canon Law, University of Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, and her license in Canon Law from St. Paul University, Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. She has served as the Director of Religious Education in parishes in the diocese, including. She is here today to give us a snapshot of Pope Francis's new document, Amoris Laetitia, which means the joy of love, and a glimpse of the work of the tribunal and the annulment process. In her brief summary of today's presentation, she states the supreme law of the church is the salvation of souls, all souls. How does the tribunal's annulment process and Pope Francis's document, Amoris Laetitia, the joy of love, hold for the salvation of souls? Please join me in welcoming.
Thank you.
I'm tired of listening.
What I want to emphasize before I even start is what Rose emphasized also is that the true meaning of canon law and what the law is all about is the salvation of souls. Whatever the church does, it does for the salvation of souls. And so that's how we judge our work. So both the tribunal and the Pope's document, Amoris Laetitia, is how do we work to save souls? And the phrase, how do we keep them dancing, not my words, we're going to see that comes from Pope Francis. And that's actually in the document. Whatever the law talks about, the reason it talks about it is because it is supposed to be something that is helpful for people to get to heaven. If it's not, it's really almost not worth talking about. The goal, people look at canon law and they look at it as a bunch of laws. Well, these laws are not restrictive. They're supposed to be telling you how you can live your life in order to get to heaven. So we don't necessarily look at the words of the law. We look at the value that underlies the law. And we could say the same thing about the document, the joy of love. What are the values that underlie this document? First of all, we have to realize that there are things that can change and things that can't change. Divine law can't change. Divine law is based on scripture and tradition. Things that are part of divine law cannot change. Part of divine law, Eucharist is Christ's body and blood. That's never going to change. That's an unchangeable piece. Now, ecclesiastical laws, those are laws made by the church. They're based on divine law, but sometimes they could change. Sources are the Code of Canon Law, the liturgical documents, okay, the Roman Missal for Mass. That can change. We've seen, anybody who's as old as I am has seen changes in the Mass, okay? It used to be in Latin, now it's in the vernacular. You never would ever be able to receive communion in your hand. It was always received on the tongue. Now we can receive communion in the hand. Now, the way we receive it may have changed, but it's still the real presence. It's still the body and blood of Christ. That has not changed. Again, that's part of the divine law, the unchangeable law, but how we receive it would be part of ecclesiastical law, and that can change. So we have to really identify the difference between what can change and what cannot change. Marriage. Okay, we see marriage in Scripture. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, no human being must separate. Okay? That gives us the understanding of marriage as marriage is for life. The bond of marriage is not broken except by the death of one of the spouses. But even Scripture realizes, but I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, unless the marriage is unlawful, causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Jesus is recognizing here that there does exist the possibility some marriages really aren't marriage as understood now by the Catholic Church at that time by Jesus. So there could be something inherently wrong with the marriage that means it doesn't live up to the standards of the church. So, in that case, a person would not be held to that marriage bond. Amoris Laetitiae. I want to start by saying everybody focuses on one chapter, chapter 8, and I'm going to talk about that. But that is not the crux of the document, okay? This is the document. Chapter 8 is only this much of the document. The rest of the document is a wonderful dissertation on love and marriage and focuses on the positives about marriage. It gives wonderful explanation of spirituality of marriage in the family. Love and marriage, chapters 4 and 5. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful presentation on what really is love in marriage and what does it look like? How does it act as part of the people? I know we have some wonderful friends here from the Marriage and Family Office. Yay! We do a lot of work with the Marriage and Family Office. They're great people. This is, love and marriage is perfectly directed towards Marriage and Family Office, people who work in the parish on, say, engagement encounters or pre-marriage preparation. You've got to read these two chapters on love and marriage. It's a wonderful thing. It's not some, oh, we're in love. Well, okay, what does that mean? Okay. Usually, by the time, you've been married a while and you start getting challenges, that whole idea of love is kind of very difficult to continue with. It also talks about the importance of the church's attention to, first of all, marriage preparation. Marriage preparation doesn't start when the couple comes to the priest and they're engaged and they've already got the halls paid for, the dresses paid for, all the money is spent. Well, this is just a formality. That's not marriage preparation. Marriage preparation starts when kids are in high school, especially juniors and seniors in high school. They're starting to date with the eye of choosing a spouse to marry. These are the kids that need our direction. We have to teach them how to choose a marriage partner. Do they know what to look for in a marriage partner? Kids that come from dysfunctional families, very often, as our tribunal cases tell us, choose the same sort of dysfunction for their own marriage. Then we get that case in the tribunal. They don't know what to look for in a true marriage partner. It's either that or, well, yeah, I know he was really nasty to me while we were dating, but I just knew once we were married, everything was going to change. The priest sprinkles a little fairy dust during the wedding ceremony. That's why the said, I ran out of that. there's no concept, okay? First years of the marriage are the most critical, okay? What happens? We marry them. Do we have anything in bring these newly married couples together to help them work through all these issues with this new state of life. Often, we just kind of ignore them until maybe they have their first kid and they appear for baptism for their child. It may be too late by that time. The things that they face may just be too difficult for them. So what do we have in place for those newly married couples to assist them? The challenges of marriage. And I know we have retrovi, which is excellent. Do we have things in place? Are we willing to reach out to those people who are facing challenges in their marital relationship? Do we help them in the formation of their children? You know, having children, any parent will tell you, that first kid is a real awakening. You know, and then as they grow up, well, then they become teenagers and all bets are off. And what do we have to help parents through these very difficult times? And that's what a lot of Amoris Laetitiae is about marriage and how we interact with married couples, how we do preparation. A very small part of it is chapter 8. But again, that's kind of what everybody wants to talk about. And what chapter 8 talks about is the person who is divorced, and a lot of times they would be remarried outside the church because they never sought the annulment. So what does chapter 8 in the document say? Two words, accompanying and discerning, are very prominent in this document. It's a pastoral discernment. It is the priest working with a person in this particular situation to see what's going on in their life, what's happening, how can I help, okay? The process of accompaniment and discernment is helping to bring this person to an awareness of their situation before God. What's going on in my life? What has happened? Where am I at now? And it is the priest helping the person work through these issues. Now, I'm not saying that this is where, oh, Father, I've been married outside the church. I don't want to bother getting an annulment, so just give me permission to receive communion. That's not what this document is saying. Unfortunately, the secular media has made it out to be this chapter is saying, now all people have to do is go to Father and he'll give them permission to marry. This document never says that. Don't believe me, read chapter 8. It does not say that. Okay? It is a process that the priest is going to use to work through to help this person. May it end up that they may be receiving communion? Maybe. But that's not a given. That's not what the aim of this is. There's a lot of situations that we are presented with. There are definitely challenges for parish staff, the priests, the deacons, the pastoral ministers, who work with people in these particular situations. There are also challenges for family members. When we work with people through the tribunal, we very often see people who are extremely angry. Sometimes they take it out on me. That's okay. I got this yet. I get called up and yelled at on a regular basis, you know. That's okay. I know it's not personal. I know it's because people are hurting, they're lashing out, and very often it's very uncharacteristic of this person. I had one person call and just go bonkers on me, and there was nothing I could say to this person. So it's like, okay, just rant. Well, I don't think it was a half hour later, I got a phone call from a priest that said, I just heard what so-and-so said to you. I'm so sorry. I'm like, well, you didn't say it, you know? Well, I just want you to know, that is not the way this person is. That is not this person's character. And, you know, I've never seen this person act like that before. Like, that's okay. It's the frustration. It's the, I want this case done. It's I have to have this. I get that. I get that. And I mean, we try to explain to people, it's usually people who have civilly remarried and haven't bothered to get an annulment yet, or possibly they're just living with this person that they want to get married to. It's tough. It's tough that they want this and they want it now. We do our best. Trust me, we do our best. But there are certain things that we have to follow, certain laws, certain procedures. So we try to work with people. We depend a lot on the people in the parish and even the people's families to try to help them understand, look, it's coming along, it's working, you just got to be patient. And patient isn't always the biggest quality that you see out there for people. And I get it. But in the parishes, that we have to say, okay, what do we have in place for people who are civilly married and living together, that are separated? Maybe they're divorced and not remarried. Not, you know, that's less of an issue. Those people can still go to communion. I wish that so many people I have come across in our programs that they're divorced, they're not remarried, they're not living with anybody, but they believe they can't go to communion. No, just because you're divorced, that doesn't change your status in the church. You can go to communion, you can be a Eucharistic minister, you can do anything in the church. Just because you're divorced, it doesn't prevent you from doing everything you can do when you were married. People don't understand that. So, you know, if you've got any friends or relatives that are under that mistaken belief, please fix that. Okay? Yes, you can go to communion, receive the sacraments, there are no restrictions, just because you're divorced. And there's no requirement to come to the church and request permission to divorce. There is something in the law that says you can come to the church and ask for permission to separate or permission to divorce, but that there is no penalty for not doing that. And truth of the matter is most people don't. So, but there is nothing that prevents a divorced person from full participation in the sacraments in the church. Single parent families, really tough. Really, really tough. Amoris Laetitiae says these people need to have special attention. It's very difficult. Anybody works with a PSR program knows you might have a child, your parents are divorced, you're only going to see that child half the time. Well, we certainly can't say, well, I'm sorry, you can't be here every week, so you can't be in our PSR program. Okay, that's never going to work. Taking it out on the child. We have to make accommodations. We have to work on this. How we teach about marriage, how we preach about marriage from the pulpit, how we teach marriage in our schools and our PSR programs. We've got to remember there's kids who have divorced parents in that class, in that congregation. We cannot teach it as something that, oh, people who get divorced are evil, okay? No, we have to have an understanding to it. You know, you've got a child in your classroom, and you start teaching about marriage, and that we don't allow divorce. Well, when my parents are divorced, does that mean they're bad people? No, it doesn't mean they're bad people, okay? The way we talk about it, the way we teach it, the way we handle it is extremely important. And it is definitely a piece that Amoris Laetitiae has said is extremely important and needs to be handled properly. We need outreach, the fidelity to the gospel of the family, but at the same time, helping those who need our help. It's a ministry of reconciliation. People who get divorced, they often feel alienated from the church. Some of them still think they're excommunicated. No, they're not excommunicated, okay? We need the art of accompaniment, which is what Amoris Laetitiae talks about, is just that, the priest, possibly other parish ministers, walking with these people, helping these people, assisting them in incorporating their life to the church. Listening with respect is a very, very big topic in the document. That we need to assimilate their problem. We need to understand their problem and show them that we're concerned about them as a person. Children are often victims. You get two parents fighting, they often take it out on the children. They often put the children in the middle. And that is one of the saddest things. So how can, one of the big things, how can we help these parents work out their differences with their former spouses and still be attentive to the needs of the children? They're the ones that really get the short end of the stick. Single parent families, that's very, very difficult. We need to be attentive to that. These are all things that we need to look at in our parishes, in the programs, and the things that we have going on to say, how are we reaching out to these people? People in our families, hey, if you have people in your family that might have these circumstances, how are you helping those people? The first help comes from the family. What can I do to help these parents with their children, to help them return to the Catholic Church if they're away? Help them understand, yes, they are Catholic. No, we have not given up on them. We have to separate the person from the action. We can't say, here's a person, person's divorced, person's no good. No, good people get divorced. It's not always their fault. We have to avoid any language or attitude that makes them feel like second-class citizens. So many times I've talked to groups, we have support groups in the diocese, wonderful groups that minister to those who are separated and divorced. So many times I've heard people say, I don't want to go to church because I'm divorced and I feel like everybody's looking at me. And they don't think I should be there. Okay? You know somebody who's divorced. Invite them to go to church with you. Sitting there alone is often very difficult for people. They need to have somebody next to them. Now, sometimes you can't understand that. I go to church by myself all the time. No big deal, okay? I'm talking to everybody else around me. Not a problem. Everybody's not like that, okay? Some people are afraid to go by themselves. Are there divorced people in your parish? Do they need somebody to reach out to them to say, hey, why don't you come to church with me? And we can go out to breakfast afterwards. Okay? Wonderful ministry there. Looking for a ministry? Really simple. You're going to go to church anyway. Bring somebody along with you. We need to get them doing things. Okay? Even if this person is divorced and remarried without the benefit of an annulment, there's still lots of things they can do with the church. Maybe they can't receive communion. They can be involved in the Bible study. They can work with St. Vincent de Paul Society. They can work with, I know I'm on St. Raphael. We do a lot of work with various, like Westside Catholic Center, et cetera. They can be involved in social justice ministries. Okay? Let's get them involved in things that they can do. Again, meeting people in their new status as a divorced person. Because we care for them, it doesn't weaken our faith, and it doesn't say, well, marriage is no longer indissoluble. Some people have that attitude. Well, if I, you know, start working with this divorced person, that's going to mean that I'm approving of divorce. No, you're approving of a person, of a human being. So what's the role of the tribunal in all of this? Well, in the tribunal, what we want to do is be an instrument of healing. We are a judicial process. We have laws that we have to follow. No choice in that one, okay? There are certain ways we have to do things. However, what we do with people is we determine if this is a valid marriage as understood by the Catholic Church. There may have been issues when the people were giving consent that stood in the way of them making the choice to marry. There may have been circumstances or other issues where we examine the marriage and we say, no, you did not have the ability to consent at the time that you were going to marry. An example. Let's take the 17-year-old girl who gets pregnant. Parents say, forget it, your history, get out, we're not going to take care of you, we're not going to take care of the baby, throws the poor girl out of the house. pregnant, the guy says, okay, I'll marry you, I'll take care of you, I'll take care of the baby. She marries this guy. Do you think she was exercising proper freedom when she made the decision to marry this guy? There was no freedom there. She was forced by circumstances to marry anybody who would agree to marry her. Okay? Say the guy is abused, ends up being abusive, they get divorced, she applies for an annulment. There would be a very good chance that we would say, hey, you know, you weren't exercising the proper freedom. You didn't have the ability to exercise the proper freedom when you made that decision. The church is not going to hold her to that bond of marriage because it's not marriage as understood by the church. So we're always looking at consent. Were people able to consent according to what the church believes proper consent to be? Our process is defined by law. We have to follow the laws that are in place. Why? Because there needs to be a process to protect our beliefs of marriage. This isn't just something where somebody comes up, hands us a piece of paper, and we stamp it and say, okay, you're good to go. Okay? It's a process with testimony, witnesses, etc. So it is very important. We don't have a choice. We have to follow the process. Because this is the way that we allow people to know really what their status is in the church. Do you really have to be held by that bond of marriage? Now, I said ecclesiastical laws can change, right? Well, back at the end of 2015, we got some actually pretty good news. The Pope issued what's called Vitis Judis Dominus Jesus, which was a change to some of the laws that we use to process marriage cases. Now, what's the good news? The good news is that there is a shorter process that's possible for some cases. Now, I get a phone call. I want St. Francis's 45-day annulment. How do I get that? Okay. There is no such thing as St. Francis. I'm St. Francis. Well, maybe one day. Pope Francis's 45-day annulment, okay? That 45 days refers to a time between after the witnesses are deposed and the decision is written. There's lots of other things that have to happen, so it's not 45 days. But that's all the testimony has to be totally in agreement. The petitioner, the respondent, the witnesses all have to agree, and the case has to be able to be handled quickly. To tell you the honest to God's truth, there's not a lot of those cases out there. But that's okay, because what this has done is also shortened the time that we're able to hear a case and the cases that we can hear. One thing, we used to not be able to hear a case if the marriage wasn't in our diocese, the respondent wasn't in our diocese, we had to get permission from the respondent's diocese to hear a case. We don't have to do that anymore. It was particularly difficult, this actually happened. We had a case where a woman was from the Philippines. She lives in our diocese. She got married in the Philippines. Her former spouse is in the Philippines. We had to send that case to the Philippines. It's sad they never heard it. They don't have functioning tribunals in many countries. Once this came out, now it says, as long as the petitioner lives in our diocese, we can hear any case, regardless of where the respondent lives, regardless of where the marriage is. We got that case back from the Philippines. Actually, we never got it back. We just said, okay, it doesn't exist. We heard the case here, and the case is done. So this is really beneficial for the people that come from, like, we have a lot of people, Hispanic people from Mexico. They're married in Mexico. Their former spouse lives in Mexico. If they live here, we can still hear the case. That's been a huge help to us. The other thing that's been a huge help is every case used to have to go to another tribunal to be ratified. We don't have to do that anymore. As long as there's no appeal by anybody, the case is done right here. It's completed here. Okay? So we have there's a lot of things that were really, really big helps to us in this new law that came out. The other thing that was a big help, I don't have it listed there, but the testimony of the parties can be used as sole proof. In other words, say we have somebody that was married back in 1950. Well, we don't have any witnesses because anybody that knew them is deceased. Well, although the law now says we can take their word as full proof as long as we have people that say, yes, they're honest and trustworthy. So that's helped us again. So what does this have to do with Amoris Laetitiae? Well, in chapter 8, we don't have to get to the point of a person going in and saying to the priest, can I receive communion? Because even though they say I can't process my annulment case, because now our ability to process cases has been greatly expanded. And the types of case, it's no longer, well, the marriage was too long ago, so we can't process the case. That's a huge help, okay? So the first thing in this whole process has got to be submit the case to the tribunal. Let's try to do things the right way from the get-go. And we have a lot more possibilities now. Now, admission to the Eucharist. Back in the 1970s, there was a process called the internal forum. And that meant if you couldn't get an annulment, you could go to the priest. The priest could give you permission to receive communion. And we actually had priests in the diocese that were appointed to assist other priests in how do we make this determination. Well, that kind of went away because in the code, Canon 915 says, those obstinately persevering in manifest grave sin are not to be admitted to the Eucharist. Being divorced and remarried outside the church was considered obstinately persevering in manifest grave sin. There was a lot of discussion about this back in the late 90s, and the Pontifical Council for the Interpretation of Legislative Texts is the council over in Rome that does advising regarding canon law and making decisions about the law. They said that if people are divorced and remarried outside the church, if they're not able to separate for serious reasons, such as they have children, they can agree to live in full continence. They can agree to live as brother and sister. They can receive the sacrament of penance and receive communion remoto scandalo, which means without scandal. So the priest was instructed to tell them to go to another parish where they weren't well known to receive communion. This is the instruction that's been in place since 2000. What's the problem with that particular thing? Is first of all, the requirement to live in full continence. If you're telling somebody you can't have sex, you're taking away one of the basic aspects of marriage. So that's really not a good thing. Amoris Laetitiae reinforces that. It says in those numbers, if you'd like to look them up in the document, but what they say is number 4 calls the sexual relationship a path of growth in the life of grace for the couple. So by telling them they can't have a sexual relationship, we're interfering in that path of growth in the life of grace. There can be no attempt whatsoever to call into question its necessity. Sexual relationship is a necessary part of marriage. Sexuality is an interpersonal language wherein the other is taken seriously in his or her sacred dignity. And we're going to tell people not to do it? It is a gift from God that enriches the relationship of the spouses. Okay, so clearly, telling people to abstain from sexual relationship, that's one of the basic goods of marriage and is essential for the marriage, is not a good thing. Okay, so we're kind of left back in, well, okay, so now what do we do? The discernment that the document talks about is not the equivalent to the internal forum. In chapter 8, it says there's not one time that it uses the word internal forum. The document speaks of discernment and accompaniment. The external forum is our tribunal process. The internal forum is what is done privately with the priest, counseling, confession. In discernment, the document is saying that this is a renewed encouragement to undertake a responsible personal and pastoral discernment. What's going on in your life?
The degree of responsibility is not equal in all cases. There is a difference between the one partner being continually unfaithful and refusing to be faithful to a partner and the aggrieved partner. So what is the person's responsibility in the breakup of this marriage? There's different levels of responsibility. It offers material for discernment discussions. That's what's in chapter 8. These are the things that we should talk about. Very importantly, says, neither the synod nor this exhortation can be expected to provide a new set of general rules, canonical in nature and applicable to all cases. Every case is different. The law does not aim to say, this is what you do and you do it in every case. We can't, because every case is different. Every case must be judged on its own merits and the two different people that are involved. What does chapter 8 say we should do? It's a discernment to find possible ways of responding to God and growing in the midst of limits. Even if a person can't go to communion, it doesn't mean they can't respond to God in different ways. By thinking that everything is black and white, we sometimes close off the way of grace and growth and discourage paths of sanctification which gives glory to God. So the aim of this is to help this person move forward and discover how it is they fit into the church and how it is they can continue to grow and achieve salvation. Remember what I started talking about, achieving salvation. Pope Francis has two really good phrases. I want to remind priests that the confessional should not be a torture chamber, but rather an encounter with the Lord's mercy. His quote, not mine, okay? The Eucharist is not a prize for the perfect, but a powerful medicine and nourishment for the weak. So, what does chapter 8 tell us? What is Pope Francis saying? Priests have the duty to accompany the divorced and remarried in helping them to understand their situation according to the teaching of the church and the guidelines of the bishop. Now, we don't have any guidelines because we... However, if priests want a little bit of insight into things that can be done, there are other areas that have put forth guidelines. Most notably, the Buenos Aires Pastoral Region has put out guidelines for their priests. This is important because this is the area that Pope Francis comes from. It's also important because Pope Francis actually wrote a letter approving their guidelines. Their guidelines can be found at that particular website if you would like to read them. Canonicalaid.org is a website that is maintained by a lay canonist, and he puts all kinds of things into the library of this website. The document from Buenos Aires, as well as Pope Francis's letter approving, I don't want to say approving them, saying that they're good guidelines, are on that. What are they saying? They're very specific. They said this is personal and pastoral discernment. It's not permission to receive the sacraments. This is not come in, talk to Father, get permission to go to communion and walk out. That's not what this is saying. The journey may not end in receiving the sacrament, but offer ways of integrating the person into the life of the church. Obtaining a declaration of nullity may not be possible, but it should be pursued. Living in complete continence may not be feasible. Amoris Laetitiae opens the possibility of receiving the sacraments, but it doesn't guarantee them in every case. It's not unrestricted access. Each case is treated separately. Unresolved injustices would make access to the sacrament scandalous. So if there is one person that is particularly, the person was unfaithful throughout the entire marriage, has told everybody that'll listen, he or she was unfaithful, giving that person access to the sacraments would not be a good thing because it would be flaunting the situation. Haha, see what I can do, and I can still go to communion. And we also have to avoid confusion about the church's teaching of marriage. It closes with the words, I invite pastors to listen with affection and serenity, with a sincere desire to enter into the heart of the drama of people and to comprehend their point of view, to help them live a better life, and to recognize their life and their place in the church. That's how Pope Francis concludes the document. A We have to have a ministry to those in irregular situations, as well as people in regular situations. We must be devoted to the pastoral care of wounded families, recognize the need for evangelization and healing. It is a personal and pastoral discernment, and we need to perfect the art of accompaniment. So, thank you for listening, and I've got
thank you so much for an informative presentation on this extremely difficult area of
I already have a list of questions, okay.
I was handed
okay, well, we'll start with these. I'll start. What criteria does the tribunal use to determine a valid marriage? Oh, that's hard to explain in 30 seconds or less. What we do is we look at the person's consent. There are many reasons. I gave the one example of how if a person may not be free to consent. Sometimes a person doesn't know the partner very well. There could be fraud. I had one case where the woman was forced by her parents to have an abortion at the age of 15. She never told the guy she married until well into the marriage. After that, the marriage was over. So that was really fraud on her part because she wasn't being honest. There's probably a couple of dozen different reasons we could use, and it would be impossible to go over all of them. However, if you would like to see what they're like, you could go onto our website. On our website, and it actually lists all the grounds and what they need. So if you want those details, anybody can access that. We have no problem with that. What is the average time frame for tribunal discernment before the judgment? I tell people, give it a year and a half. I've had cases that I've done in 6 to 9 months, or I've had cases that have taken longer. The key is the response of the witnesses. If we get poor witness participation, that becomes difficult because then each judge has an auditor that works with us, and that auditor spends a lot of time chasing down witnesses. So the response of the witnesses is critical, and that usually is a key player in the time frame. So, you know, it can be anywhere from 6 to 9 months. Average is a year and a half. It could be longer if it's a complicated case. What percentage of applicants are granted an annulment or denied? All cases do not receive an affirmative decision. It's hard to give an actual percentage because there's a lot of issues in play. First of all, we have a lot of people that withdraw their cases. We have a lot of people that we put cases in the inactive file because they lose interest and they stop participating. So, you know, we have those cases that get stopped that would be part of the percentage. Also, if there is a negative decision, and this was the next question in appeal, if there is a negative decision here, the person has the right to appeal to our second instance court, which is either, if that second instance court gives an affirmative decision, they can then act on that affirmative decision. So yes, if we get a negative, it can still go to another court, get an affirmative, and it's granted. That's another part of this new law with NIDIS that is different than before. So, yes, if you get a negative decision, you can appeal it, and you can add additional information to your case during this appeal, and it could actually be granted.
Several questions here. How does a good Catholic respond with a short explanation to someone that is critical of the Catholic Church's annulment process?
A short answer? Okay, yeah, right. I think the crux of the matter is, even if you want to go back to one of the original things of scripture that I said, unless the marriage is unlawful, okay, even in scripture, there was a recognition that some marriages may not rise to the level of that type of marriage that we would consider valid. So what the church, annulment is not a Catholic divorce. Annulment is the church looking at the marriage to see if it had all the qualities required for a valid marriage. And I guess that's about the shortest answer that I can give. It's either that or take my phone number, have them call me.
Let's try this. About a non-Catholic divorce, marry a Catholic, never married. How do they proceed?
Okay, the Catholic Church recognizes all marriages, whether a person's Catholic or non-Catholic. If you're Catholic, you have to get married in the church, or the the church is not going to recognize that marriage. Non-Catholics, we don't hold non-Catholics to any particular standard of where they marry. So any marriage between two non-Catholic people is considered valid, except the Orthodox. The Orthodox are required to marry in front of an Orthodox priest. But anybody else, there's no requirements for other religions like Lutheran, Methodist, etc. So wherever they marry, as long as it's valid legally, we accept it, and that non-Catholic person would have to submit a case to the tribunal in order to be able to marry that Catholic person validly in the church.
Okay, can you address a couple who want to marry, but the fellow cannot complete the sexual act? He is a quadriplegic, and they marry.
Okay, the law says antecedent and perpetual impotence is an impediment to marriage, which means no, they cannot marry validly in the church. Now, this means perpetual. It means that there is no way for it to be fixed. Now, I don't know if any of you are familiar with, the husband was in the accident. Her husband was in an accident, was paralyzed from the waist down. Well, after he was paralyzed from the waist down, they had another child. So what hurt, if you ever heard her, she would say, doesn't always mean that. So it's just, if somebody absolutely, totally impotent and no hope, because you can't complete the sexual act is necessary to consummate the marriage. The marriage is not consummated, the church doesn't consider it intermarriage.
What is an example, if any, of an approved annulment that would be appealed?
Okay, sometimes a respondent simply doesn't agree with the fact that this case got an affirmative decision, and the respondent would appeal it. Sometimes the respondent says, I just don't want this to happen, and doesn't give a real reason. Other times the respondent would say, well, but I don't believe that's true, that's true, or that's true, and they have the right to appeal. We don't require real detailed reasons for appeal. Because it's a right that they have in the law, we allow the appeal and let the second instance court do their job.
Who sits on the tribunal and makes the decision?
There are four judges on the tribunal, Father, who is also the judicial vicar, myself, and the lay people. We form a college of three judges. And this college makes the decision. Okay, ultimately it's the college that makes the decision. Two out of the three judges must agree on the decision.
This we're going to take as the last question. You may want to put these on your website.
There are a lot of this information is on our website. And I mean, I would stay here. People have individual questions. I'm happy to stay here longer if you have the time and have a particular question. But look at our website, Diocese of. We've got all these kind of questions and answers on the website. But go ahead.
For the last one. What chance does a divorced person have for an annulment if the person's partner who was unfaithful in marriage will not consent to participating in the annulment process?
Very good question. The respondent does not have to participate. What we have to do is we have to notify the person the case is there and give them the opportunity to participate. They have time limits. If they don't respond in the time limits, we move on with the case goes forward. So I never want to hear anybody say, well, I can't do this because my former spouse won't agree to it or won't consent to it. Not the case. We go ahead, we move forward with the case,